This is a Historic England podcast, sponsored by Ecclesiastical Insurance Group.
Hello, I'm Dr. Susanna Lipscomb from the University of Roehampton, and you're listening to Irreplaceable, a History of England in 100 Places. In this series, we explore the amazing places that together tell the story of England. 10 expert judges have worked across 10 categories and thousands of your nominations to compile a list of 100 places which have helped make England the country it is today. If you're enjoying the series, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And if you're listening on iTunes, please rate this podcast and leave a very nice review. Today, we reveal two more industry, trade and commerce locations that have been chosen by our judge, Dr. Tristram Hunt. Joining me in the studio to discuss these are my guests, Charles Smith from Historic England and Professor Emma Griffin, a social and economic historian from the University of East Anglia. We begin with our seventh location, which is in Stoke-on-Trent. This is Middleport Pottery, which is home to the world-famous handcrafted Burley pottery. The site was built in 1888 and was considered cutting-edge in its layout at the time. The building has recently been given a new lease of life through a restoration project, and visitors can now explore the working factory site, the Victorian offices and the bottle kiln area. And this is what our judge, Dr. Tristram Hunt, had to say.
Middleport Pottery near Burslem stood just outside my constituency of Stoke-on-Trent Central, but it is one of the great reminders of the culture of the potteries, those six towns in North Staffordshire, which produced a world historic footprint in terms of ceramic design and production. And there was an ethos and a design around the pot banks. So whether it was the bottle kilns, whether it was the factories, whether it was the chimneys that came with it, that encouraged authors like Arnold Bennett to think of it like a Dutch town or an Italian Renaissance cityscape, that there is a civic beauty to the architecture of the potteries that you have to go and see for yourself.
We visited a Middleport Pottery to find out more from Heritage Manager Hayley Underwood with a little bit of help from tour guide Rob Jones.
Welcome to Middleport. I'm about to take you on the journey of clay from the raw material to the finished product. As we walk around the factory, you'll see the way the factory was laid out by its wonderful architect, Absalom Reed Wood, shows a flow pattern.
When you go into the working factory itself, there are processes that are taking place in there that are unchanged since Victorian times. It was built in 1888 by Burgess and Lee, who built the site as a brand new factory. It was purpose-built and it was known as the model pottery because production processes were designed to be in order, so they streamlined production and made for a much more efficient process. The company continued to produce throughout two world wars and really had its boom time around the 1920s and 30s. That was the heyday of the pottery industry, the golden age, if you like, in the city. Everything that's for sale in the factory shop is still produced here on site. Each piece of ware goes through approximately 25 pairs of hands. So it really is a living, breathing site. We're also unique in that we have the underglazed tissue transferring process. So this is a method that's been used since Victorian times, and that uses copper scrolls to transfer designs onto tissue, which is then printed onto ware, so onto a plate or a cup. And then the tissue paper's peeled off and the ware then goes off to be glazed and fired. So we're the only place that does underglaze tissue transferring. So there's many unique things that if Middleport Pottery wasn't here would simply disappear. So it really is irreplaceable. One of the things we're particularly proud of is our William Bolton steam engine. It's original to the factory and it did power the factory in its Victorian heyday. It's connected to a series of pulleys, for want of a better way of describing it, that pass through the walls to different rooms in the factory. So there's a series of ropes and gears, and as the large wheel on the steam engine turned, that then powered different machinery in the factory. It was restored 2 years ago thanks to some grant funding by a team of conservation experts and some of our fantastic volunteers. We're now able to operate it actually using steam again. It's amazing watching young children be fascinated by seeing this huge equipment. You can toot the whistle on the steam engine, and just watching their faces light up is really rewarding, and it really shows how heritage restoration can really touch people of all generations. It's just a different experience than reading about something to actually see it living, breathing, working again. I think Middleport pottery is a great choice for industry, trade and commerce to represent that, mainly because of the long history that it's had. You can't deny that a company that's been able to persist through 150 years throughout the decline of the pottery industry, and it's still going. There has been something of a revival of interest in British-made arts and crafts and traditional skills over the last few years, and Middleport pottery has been at the forefront of that. One of the things that we continue to support at Middleport Pottery is UK-based trade and industry. We're really a hub for small businesses, the crafts movement. So we have things like a furniture maker on site, obviously a series of ceramicists, as well as things like jewellery makers. So we really do support other crafts and activities as well as the traditional pottery factory. And it really goes to show how historic buildings can be sustainable.
That's Heritage Manager at Middleport Pottery, Hayley Underwood, taking us through just some of the many fascinating aspects of the site. So, as we heard, this factory is a wonderful example of how early streamlined factory processes work, the idea of bringing everything together to create a more efficient manufacturing setup. Can you elaborate on this?
With any manufacturing setup, you need several key things. You need the raw materials. So we're in Staffordshire, you've got the clay, it's there. You need the transport. It was strategically located alongside the Trent and Mersey Canal to transport goods in and out. And of course, you need the production facility. And this is where it was actually really quite innovative, this place. They really thought about the design to make it as efficient as possible. For example, traditional potteries had often been a lot more chaotic in their layout and grouped around bottle kilns. But here we have a very efficient linear pattern to the design of the development. For example, passages between areas are just the right size to allow carts to move through. And of course, horse and carts were absolutely integral to the process of moving goods in those days. So a really interesting, innovative way of designing a manufacturing unit.
I think one of the other things that's really nice about this area is we tend to think with industrialisation of big, dirty and useful things like cotton and cloth and iron and coal. We kind of think big and dirty. And what's really nice about this example is what they're making are decorative, delicate fripperies, if you like, extra nice things. Now that we've got a wealthier population who's working in industry and who have more disposable income, they don't need to spend all of their money just on food and clothes and shoes and boots. They can have nice things to decorate their homes. They can eat off a china plate instead of out of a wooden bowl. You know, it's a really nice example about the rise of consumerism that's happening at this time as well.
And it must have been great for the workers as well. A real sense of satisfaction to come out at the end of a working day having produced really beautifully integrate end products that would decorate people's living rooms and elsewhere.
It's really just about kind of enhancing our kind of experience of life. And as the industrialisation tends to be all about kind of the dirty and the dark and the miserable. And it's a nice example that industrialisation had a brighter side to it as well.
They really are beautiful, the Birtley pottery things, even today. If anyone wants to enhance my life by sending me some, that would be great. So Middleport pottery is an excellent example of an irreplaceable site. It has so many unique qualities. But let's now move from clay to coal for our next site, which demonstrates how the coal industry in the northeast of England connected to, and literally fueled, of course, the rest of the country. Our eighth location is Dunstan Staithes in Gateshead, built to transport coal along the River Tyne. This huge wooden jetty curves out across the Tyne like a giant wooden snake, and it's thought to be one of the largest timber structures in Europe. The Staithes are a kind of, craggy, dark, huge structure, but the enormity of it sort of belies the elegance of the structure as well and how useful it was at the time. Let's hear from our category judge, Tristram Hunt. Why does he think it's important to celebrate this symbol of our industrial past?
Dunstan Staithes shows the manner in which the infrastructure of the UK had to keep up with the processes of industrialisation. And so after the canals came the trains and the railway system, and with that, the infrastructure to export. And this is a reminder, in a sense, of Britain as the workshop of the world, that the coal which came out of Britain, the manufactured goods which came out of Britain, then needed ports and docks and export stops to go around the world. And this surviving infrastructure connecting the rail to the port head to the world is a very good example of what today we would call global Britain.
Now, dare I say it, this is something of a Marmite location. You probably either love it or hate it, at least in terms of how it looks. But what it represents is what makes it irreplaceable, don't you think?
Oh, I think absolutely. And I love the fact that we've transitioned from a delicate china bowl that people are eating their soup out of to the bread and butter of the Industrial Revolution. We've got large infrastructure project. And I think it just really draws to life what a kind of multifaceted phenomenon industrialization is. And just to repeat, in Britain, at the heart of it is coal, and coal is heavy and it's hard to move around. And so much of what's going on in terms of technology and engineering at this time is figuring out ways to get the coal out of the ground and then to move it around the country. And I think this is so important to the process of industrialisation, and it's exactly what we see here at Dunstan Staithes.
Yeah, and it's absolutely remarkable that this exposed timber structure, and it has to be seen to be believed, is actually still there, of course. We think of, you know, iron-framed buildings, we think of reinforced concrete buildings, we think of traditional solid stone buildings surviving, of course we do. But big timber-framed industrial exposed structures like this, still surviving today, albeit out of use, is a remarkable thing and something well worth preserving for the future.
And I think what I like about this structure is it reminds us how very important the Tyne was as one of the most important working rivers in the world, and that the industry and the shipyard, the power of coal, tell us this important part of English history.
Absolutely. So much of industrialisation really bore the imprint of what was there before, whether it was what agriculture was there, what industry was there, what resources are there. And of course, in this area, we have the coal. So much ingenuity is going to figuring out ways of getting the coal out of the ground. But we've also got the advantage of this great river that means you can move the coal around the country. And these things are symbiotic. Part of the reason that the industry develops here is precisely because you can get the coal where you need it, off over to Lancashire, where you want it in the mills, and down to London, where people want to cook food and warm houses.
And the statistics are quite astonishing. In 1913, the Great North Coalfield employed almost 250,000 men, producing over 56 million tonnes of coal every single year from across 400 pits. So it was absolutely the lifeblood of the Northeast.
And they were men. And that's quite unusual in terms of industrialisation, because a lot of industry actually wants female workers, it wants women workers. So over in Lancashire, we've got enormous employment of women, and here, just the other side of the country, the workforce is very, very male dominated.
And so coal mining is the lifeblood of industry and a key part of life in the Northeast. But of course, for those men going to do it, actually, it was a pretty dangerous industry, wasn't it?
It's a really dangerous industry. I mean, there's no health and safety, so there's very little regulation in terms of how to keep mines safe. The technology is not always particularly good at knowing how to keep people safe underground, but even what they did know was not necessarily enforced because there was no kind of legislative framework for that. It's very dangerous work underground in and of itself. And of course, there are these long-term diseases that accrue, even if you're not killed in an accident. Most miners aren't killed in an accident, but you still do a lot of damage to your lungs, potentially working underground. So there's a lot of ill health in these areas.
It's hard for us to envisage actually going underground in this day and age, in this country, with handpicks in cramped conditions, with terribly polluted conditions, and working there solidly for hours and hours on end. But that's, of course, what people did, and that was normal. And not only for those workers themselves was it important, the coal industry, it was also important to communities as well. Communities built up around these coal fields.
Well, I'd be surprised if we don't have a former miner or two listening, or at least their descendants. And of course, we've got this major part of the story that we mustn't miss, thinking about the Northeast, is the miners' strike in the 1980s.
Absolutely. So you have this area of the country that is really dependent on one industry. And then we have a government, kind of a top-down government-imposed decision to really close that industry in the 1980s with Margaret Thatcher. So, of course, that led to a very bitter legacy in these regions.
And although we do export an amount of coal today, it's hardly anything compared to what we used to export. I mean, 156 collieries were closed nationwide as a result of that programme of closure, which does, of course, leave a long-lasting effect on those communities that have built their lives around those coalfields.
So these were the last working staiths on the River Tyne, but they had to close, of course, as these changes you've been talking about occurred. What's the site used for today, though?
It's a Grade 2 listed site. Members of the public can actually go and visit it on occasions, which is a great thing. But what's really interesting is that it's actually turned into an ecological site of interest. So it provides a natural habitat for birds, for saltwater plants, for other types of animals, which is quite astonishing. Do you think that it was a very environmentally unfriendly process for which it was actually operated, but now is actually an ecological site of interest?
Absolutely, Charles, but it's just exactly the same story as with something like the Norfolk Broads, where in the Middle Ages we were digging out the peat. And then by the 20th century, we think this is a beautiful nature reserve. And it is a nature reserve, but it's one that's born on the back of an earlier generation's economic activity.
Which they needed to do, to live. What a fascinating couple of places we've looked at today. Quite a contrast. That's all for this episode. Thanks again to my guests Charles Smith and Emma Griffin, and to our judge Tristram Hunt for his comments. We've got two more industry, trade and commerce locations to reveal next time. So join us all then, and don't forget to subscribe to this show on your podcast app. You can join the conversation by using the hashtag 100places. That's the number 100. And find out more online at historicengland.org.uk/100places. I'm Susanna Lipscomb, and I'll catch you next time.
This is a Historic England podcast, sponsored by Ecclesiastical Insurance Group. When it feels irreplaceable, trust Ecclesiastical.